It's great to be here with you all again. As I've said before and say every time, this is home for us, and you all are like family, and many of you actually are family because we have a big family. But we love coming back and being with you. And on that note, I wanted to give a special thanks to Val, because she came this week and gave a poem that she wrote for us. And it actually was talking exactly about what I wanted to share today, talking about God's promises and being faithful and obedience to him. So thank you for that. That was really great. Appreciate it. So the promises of God. I think we all have our fair share of entitlement, which is one of the consequences of being human. But that's not what I'm talking about today. I'm talking about the things that have been promised to us by God, the things that have been pledged and etched into our souls and into our hopes and dreams. And we recognize these promises when they're made, and we carry them around with us for a lifetime. So one example that I can give from my life is the promise that our son Leon represents. Julie and I fully believe that God is the one that brought Leon into our lives and into our family, and that he promised that Leon would be our son. And that's something that we both felt so strongly from the first time we met him in an orphanage in Niamey, Niger, when he was just 2 months old. And we felt that promise so strongly that it has sustained us through the adoption process, which we're still in the midst of and probably will be for the foreseeable future. So we stand on that promise. We hold to it and we hold on to it. In fact, we cling to it. So I would like to look at this idea of the promise of God through the story of Joshua and the coming into the promised land, and specifically the taking of the city of Jericho, which is in the first six chapters of Joshua. So we won't read the whole six chapters, but we'll just sort of jump around. And I think it's a good example because it shows that the fulfillment of promises is a journey, and sometimes a long journey. God promised the children of Israel that they would bring them into the promised land, but it wasn't easy. And the same is true of the promises that we've been given. There are many obstacles that stand in our way and that things that can prevent us from reaching our goal. But God is with us and he is faithful. So talking about Deuteronomy with the parasha this morning, Joshua picks up right where Deuteronomy leaves off. Moses has died on the other side of the Jordan River, looking over into the promised land. And he had brought the children of Israel out of slavery in Egypt and through the desert, and he made it just to the edge of the promised land, but didn't make it in. And now Joshua is declared the leader and given the task of bringing them the rest of the way. So they're there, perched on the border, and they can see the promise in front of them. But they're separated from it by a river and also by their fear. In Joshua 1, we won't read it, but God basically says, now I'm going to take you across the river and bring you into this land that I promised you, and everything is ready. All you have to do is obey me. And that's significant because, as you all know, I'm sure, they had been at that point before. The people of Israel had been perched and ready to enter the promised land 40 years earlier. God had brought them to the edge of the promise and was ready to conquer for them, but they had been too afraid. So they were defeated in the end, not by their enemies, because they didn't even face their enemies. They were defeated by their own fear. And so this time had to be different. This time they had to get it right because they couldn't afford to fail again. But they must have still been afraid, and you can tell that they must have been afraid because in the first few verses of Joshua 1, God repeatedly tells them to not be afraid. So it makes sense. He was trying to reassure them in their fear. So I'll just read he says it three or four times, sort of climaxing in verse 9. This is Joshua 1, verse 9. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid, nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. So I think that it shows that God knew that the children of Israel were afraid, and he knew that they were really at an important moment. They were sort of teetering on the brink of fear and flight again. And it's easy for us to brush aside their fear because we know the end of the story. We know what happens after. But they actually had good reason to be afraid. Facing Jericho wasn't easy. It was really strategically located, you know, between the river and the mountain range, so you could sort of defend. Anyone coming would have to cross one of those two obstacles. So sort of a naturally good place to defend. Everyone likes quoting from Mark Twain's Innocents Abroad around here, so I will too, because he talked about Jericho when he went there. He wrote, its site will always remain unoccupied, the ruins, because he saw the ruins. And yet, it is one of the best locations for a town we have seen in all Palestine. So even Mark Twain could tell it was a good place for a city. So anyway, Jericho was a big obstacle to overcome. And especially right at the very beginning of this conquest, at the very outset, they actually hadn't even started yet because they were still on the other side of the river looking over. And all they could see were the big walls of Jericho. Excuse me. And so sometimes life is like that. I think, you know, we face big challenges that we feel totally unprepared for. And it feels unfair. We feel like saying, I'm not ready to deal with this yet. Sometimes we feel like that when we wake up in the morning, not ready for this day. And the Battle of Jericho was important because it would set the tone for the whole rest of the war, because it was the first battle. So it wasn't easy, and they knew that it would only get more difficult even after that, because, you know, looking across the river, they see the big walls of Jericho, and beyond that, they see the mountain range that they would have to face eventually. So it was literally going to be uphill the whole way. But through their fear, God gives them a sign, which restored their courage and their strength, which is in Joshua 2. And so that's when they send the spies over, and you know the whole story with Rahab, which I'm not going to go into now. But it's important to remember what happened the last time they sent spies across the river to check 40 years earlier also. They had come back with a message of fear, and their fear had spread throughout the camp. And the children of Israel refused to cross over and refused to obey God. So this time, the spies came back, but they had a different message. They came and said that Jericho was actually afraid of them. So I just want to read really quick in Joshua 2, verses 8 through 11. Now, before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof, and she said to them, this is Rahab speaking to them, to the spies, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you, for the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. So even in Jericho, the people had heard about what God had done for the people of Israel, and the whole countryside was afraid of their coming. So it was kind of funny. The children of Israel were afraid, but everyone else was afraid of them. They were kind of like the lion in the Wizard of Oz, if you've seen that film. They didn't have any courage. But when they heard this message from the spies and heard that everyone was afraid of them, it totally changed everything for them and made them bold, because they understood that God had already won the victory, and all they had to do was claim it and follow him in obedience. So God had told them to be strong and courageous, and then he also gave them a sign and provided them with the courage that they needed. And it's interesting to hear from Rahab here why the people of Jericho were afraid. They were afraid because they knew that God was with the children of Israel, and that he wasn't just a God, but he was the God who was sovereign over heaven and earth. And that's an important distinction to make. Because generally gods are confined to a specific geographic location. And if you're there and if you serve them, they can protect you. But if you leave, it's not always sure that they can follow you. So for the children of Israel who were nomads wandering in the desert, who were former slaves without a home, to attack a big fortified city was not only to attack a well-defended and walled fortress, but also to dislodge a god that was firmly in place, a god that was well entrenched. So how could a band of ragged nomads do that? But God had already shown that he's not like the other gods and that there were no limitations for him. He was in Egypt and he had been in the desert and he would cross over the river with his people as well. So the people of Jericho knew that. But what about the children of Israel? Yes, they were glad that to hear that, that people were afraid of them and that Jericho was afraid. But part of them might have still been thinking, okay, yes, God did all of these great things for us, but that was a long time ago. And that was when Moses was with us. Even though they had pledged to follow Joshua as they had followed Moses, they probably still had some doubts and some fears. So what does God do? He gives them another sign to show them that he's in control and that no obstacle can stand in his way. And that's in Joshua 3, when they cross over the river. And they do it in the same way, in the similar way, as they had done when they crossed the Red Sea with Moses. And I think it's also important to remember that for almost all of them, they hadn't actually been there when they crossed the Red Sea. Many of the firsthand witnesses were gone by that point. So for this new generation, it was an important demonstration that God was still with them and still able to do the impossible. And I think we need this type of reminder to be reminded of God's power, even if it was 40 years ago or 4,000 years ago or if it was yesterday, because we're so quick to forget. And that's why Joshua and made sure that the people would remember by erecting the memorial after they crossed over. And we won't read about that, but they took stones out of the river and made a memorial so that they would be able to remember, even if all the firsthand witnesses are gone, the future generations would be able to point to it and know what God had done. And that's because memory is very central to faith. And it's amazing, I think, how quick we are to forget the blessings in our lives and how quick we are to remember any injustice or insult or any slight, no matter how slight. It's of all the things that I've forgotten in my life, I can still remember in perfect detail, like insults that someone said to me in high school years ago, you know. And you can ask Julie, I rarely remember anything that well. And that's really the story of the people of Israel. God does something incredible for them, and it seems impossible that they would ever doubt him or forget, and yet they do every time and usually right away. It's a recurring theme that we see throughout the Bible, and really it's the recurring theme. That's why biblical faith and religion is all based on remembrance. All of the feasts and the ceremonies from Passover to the Eucharist, from if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, to do this in remembrance of me, is all based on remembering what God has done and holding on to what God has done, being faithful to his faithfulness. And the memory and that loyalty is what helps us make it through, even when the miracle of his presence is gone. We experience his presence and we know that we will remember it forever. And then it goes and is gone and forgotten. It comes like a flash and burns out like a flame. And throughout the ages, the imagery associated with these encounters between man and God is always fire, a fire that burns. We see that with Moses and the burning bush, to the coals on unclean lips, and the ecstasy of Saint Teresa. That flame that burns but does not consume, which is painful and pleasurable and holy and whole. Another Joshua, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, calls these encounters with God ineffable, something that we feel but cannot identify as it passes through us, fleeting and ferocious, just like fire. It is real, dangerously real, and also ethereal, destructive but delicate. We are burned by the flames and yet drawn to it again and again. Ever present, it is always gone in a second. It is a word we cannot speak, but a word that we savor in our mouths. So speaking of Heschel, I would like to just read a couple of quotes from him, if you'll indulge me, where he describes this type of encounter with the divine. Because I could spend all of my time trying to describe it in my own words and maybe even feel a little bit proud of what I come up with. And then I read his prose and it's just, I feel silly. So it's better to just quote from him. A tremor seizes our limbs. Our nerves are stuck, quivering like strings. Our whole being bursts into shudders. And then a cry, wrested from our very core, fills the world around us, as if a mountain were suddenly about to place itself in front of us. It is one word, God. Not an emotion, a stir within us, but a power, a marvel beyond us, tearing the world apart. The word that means more than universe, more than eternity, holy, holy, holy. We cannot comprehend it. We only know it means infinitely more than we are able to echo. Staggered, embarrassed, we stammer and say, He is more, He who is more than all there is, who speaks through the ineffable, whose question is more than our minds can answer, He to whom our life can be the spelling of an answer. And this is from a book called Man is Not Alone. So that burning ecstasy that we can experience in God's presence is essential to faith, but we can't live in that flash. We strive for it and seek after it, but it comes and goes, and that is its nature. So in order to hold on to it, even after it's gone, we have to remember, and we have to have something in place to help us remember. And that is why Heschel calls faith loyalty to an event. So I want to read two other quick passages from Heschel that talks about this. He writes, memory is a source of faith. To have faith is to remember. Jewish, or I would say biblical, faith is a recollection of what happened to Israel in the past. The events in which the Spirit of God become a reality stand before our eyes, painted in colors that do not fade. And again, he writes, in every man's life there are moments when there is a lifting of the veil at the horizon of the known, opening a sight of the eternal. Each of us has at least once in his life experienced the momentous reality of God. But such experiences or inspirations are rare events. To some people, they are like shooting stars, passing and unremembered. In others, they kindle a light that is never quenched. The remembrance of that experience and the loyalty to the response of that moment are the forces that sustain our faith. In this sense, faith is faithfulness, loyalty to an event, loyalty to our response. So, back to Joshua. Another important event happens on their way to Jericho. They've crossed over the river. And then in Joshua 5, I'm just going to read verse 11 and 12. They ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. Then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. So the manna stopped. And well, first of all, they celebrated the Passover, and then the manna stopped. So I'm sure you all know also all about the manna, so I won't talk about it too much. But one thing that is interesting, I think, about it is that, you know, it was collected every day. It was just there on the ground, and there was always an abundance, but you couldn't store it up. You couldn't save it because it would go bad, except on Shabbat. So you had to go back for it every day. You could take as much as you want, but you always had to go back for it every single day. And I think that's just a really powerful example of God providing for his people, even in an impossible situation. And it shows that we're dependent on God and that we wait for his daily bread. But also that our dependence on him and our relationship with him is on his terms. Because we would like to stockpile everything that we need so that we don't have to depend on him or anyone anymore. But that's not how it works. We are dependent on him and we have to be in regular daily contact and communication with him. So the manna stopped, and I think probably for the children of Israel that was pretty scary. Because yes, they complained about the manna a lot. They said, we want meat. Why do we have to eat this stuff all the time? But they had depended on it for such a long time, and they could depend on it. It was a faithful source of life for so many years, and now it just stopped. And it probably felt like that source of life had dried up and that God had somehow abandoned them. But the reason that the manna stopped is because they didn't need it anymore. And they were in the promised land. And that's the second part of verse 12. They tasted for the first time the fruit of the promise. And it's like God was saying, look, this is what I've prepared you for. This is what you've been waiting for. But first you have to trust me and follow me. So this brings an image to mind. I've heard that mother birds sometimes push their baby birds out of the nest in order to get them to fly for the first time. I've also heard that that's not actually true and that birds don't actually do that. But for the sake of this illustration, let's assume that they do that. Because the mother birds know that the baby is ready to fly, even if the baby bird may not think that it's ready. So it's sort of like a push of love, because the mother knows if they don't push the bird out, they're just going to stay comfortably in the nest forever and never learn to really use their wings and reach their full potential. So they need a push. And we may receive that kind of push from God, but not before we're ready and not before we've received a taste of the promise that awaits us. So the manna stopped. And the children of Israel had really reached the point of no return here, because the river was behind them and the walls of Jericho were in front of them. So there was no turning back. They were ready to begin, but all they needed was their instructions. They needed a strategy and their marching orders. So God sends them a message with his orders. So I'm just going to read. This is in Joshua 5. If you'd like to read along, I'm just going to read verse 13 through 15. And it came to pass, when Joshua was by Jericho, that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn to his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, Are you for us or for our adversaries? So he said, No. But as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, What does my Lord say to his servant? Then the commander of the Lord's the commander of the Lord's army said to Joshua, Take your sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy. And Joshua did so. And then I'm not going to read it, but the beginning of verse 6, he gives him the marching orders, the strategy for taking Jericho, which you all know was a bit strange. It was marching around and blowing trumpets and shouting. Joshua could have been thinking, what kind of strategy is that? but I feel like God was making a point here. He wanted it to be very clear to them that this is my battle and this is my victory. And you cannot defeat Jericho, but that's okay, because I will. And remember, the victory is mine, won by my strength, just as the land is mine, created by my power. And I think that is also another reoccurring theme that we see throughout the Bible, because God always has a strategy in all of these situations that his people have faced. And often they make no sense logically. They make no sense. But that's because he wants to make clear that the victory is won through his strength and not ours. So think of Gideon, for example. He sent away all of the men in his army except for 300. But it didn't matter, because God doesn't need us. He's chosen to accomplish his will through us, but he doesn't need us. And also, if you look at the question that Joshua asks here with the when he meets with the commander of the army of the Lord, and he says, are you for us or for our enemies? That seems like a pretty normal question to ask, you know, especially in a time of battle when you meet someone with their sword drawn. But the answer that he gets is anything but normal. He says, no. But I take that to sort of mean neither. I'm not on your side or your enemy's side. I'm on God's side. And I think sometimes we think that if we follow God, he'll fight all of our wars and our battles for us. But it isn't true, because we fight on God's side. And we fight God's fights. And the problems arise when we start fighting our own fight, especially when we claim that we're fighting it for God. And I mean, if anyone in the whole history of the world could have ever legitimately claimed that God was on their side, it would have been Joshua in this instance, because God said, go do it, and so he's going to do it. But God didn't say that. He said, you're still fighting my fight. And then he says, take off your shoes. This is holy ground. Because he wanted to make it clear that the promised land was holy land and that as such it belongs to God. Yes, God said, I want you to come in and live in this land and take care of it for me and purify it from all evil and all false gods. But don't ever start to think for a second that it's your land, that it belongs to you, because the land is holy because it belongs to God. And that's why it had to be purified. And the same thing you see afterwards with the spoils of war. They were to give it all to God, and God gave them victory over Jericho and the rest of the land, not so that they could become rich, but so that they could glorify him. And in Joshua 7, when Achan, one of the children of Israel, keeps it and suffers the consequences, we see that. And it ties into what Gary was talking about, the blessing of obedience, but the curse of disobedience. So we fight God's fight, and we have victory through God's strength. And as you all know, also, eventually Israel forgot this, even though they had many reminders like the Passover and the feast, and eventually it led to their exile. So this is a message that we need to heed and make sure that we're seeking God's will and not seeking our own will and calling it God's will to justify what we want. And the point is, we don't get to ask God if he's on our side. We're supposed to be on his side. We're supposed to align ourselves with him and our will with his will, our goals with his goals. So, to quote from Heschel one last time, he writes, the task is not to know the unknown, but to be penetrated with it. Not to know, but to be known to him. To expose ourselves to him rather than him to us. Not to judge and to assert, but to listen and to be judged by him. And another writer, Martin Buber, writes about God's awful freedom. He calls it God's awful freedom, which basically means we don't own God. He promises to be with us. He promises us his presence. And Martin Buber wrote a lot about the encounter at the burning bush when God told his name, Ihyeh Asher Ihyeh. And that figures into a lot of his theology. But the bottom line is God is promises us his presence, but he's free and he's not bound to anything. He's not bound by a name or by an image or a temple or a human conception of who he is and what he should do. And in the end, Jericho fell, even with its walls and its strength, because nothing can stand in the way of God's will and God's strength. God is with us no matter what we face, but our job is to seek to know his will and to follow his marching orders. Excuse me. And sometimes all we have is God's promise. And this has been true in our case with the adoption, just to close the loop. Because so far we've been able to foster Leon and he's been living with us, but we haven't officially completed the adoption. We don't have really legal guardianship. And we still have to do the adoption in Niger and then eventually do it in America and eventually here also in Israel. So there's a long process. We're far from finished. But we have to hold on to the promise that God made, that Leon would be our son. And we've begun to live that promise in a tangible way, because he's been living with us since he's 4 months old, and we've fully embraced him as our son. And the papers that will eventually declare him to be our son are important, but they're not what will make him our son. Because God already made him our son when he spoke his promise into our lives. Yes, the papers will grant us legal guardianship and custody, but God already made us parents long ago. When we first met Leon, I really wanted to secure some sort of custody before bringing him home, because that seemed to be prudent and wise, and it probably is. But in the end, we decided to take a leap of faith and trust in God's promise. And we had to consciously decide to embrace him as our son in spite of the risk. And I can say honestly that we've been blessed by him over and over again ever since. And every significant milestone that he achieves in his life feels like a taste of the promise to come. So we've been living in that promise for almost 3 years now, living and loving in the face of doubt and uncertainty. And it's been a very difficult process. But through it all, we've learned a lot about patience and seeking God's will and faith. Because I think in the end, that's what the essence of faith is. It's not something that can be based on any kind of certainty. It can't be based on a legal document or a piece of paper. It's based on the promises of God. So, thank you. Let's just pray to close. Dear God, thank you for this day, and thank you for this chance to meet together in fellowship and to look at your word together. Just thank you for your love and for the promises that you've made to us and the blessings that you've given us all. Just ask that you would help us all to continue to seek after your will and to follow you in obedience. In your name we pray. Amen.